we'll swing right into it. So let's, the tape recorder is now on. It is Wednesday, November 10th at 7:06 in Washington, D.C. This is Gary Cohen. I'm the General Counsel of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. With me is our Executive Director, Wendy Edelberg, and Alexis Simmendinger, one of our senior staff members. We are recording this interview, and Mr. Lazier, if you want to introduce yourself and your counsel.
Sure. I'm Ed Lazier. I am currently a faculty member at Stanford University. I was formerly the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from 2006 to 2009. My counsel is Emmett Flood. Emmett, do you want to just jump in and give a brief introduction?
No, that's good enough, Emmett Flood. I'm a lawyer here in Washington at Wayne and Collins.
Okay. He needs no introduction. And you consent to this interview being taped?
Yes, I do.
Okay, very good. And if when we're done, if you'd like a copy of it, we can send you a digital file for you to listen to all of us talking for however long we talk.
Thank you.
With that, I will turn it over to Alexis and Wendy, who I'm sure have a lot of questions about the financial crisis and our role. As you know, we are directed by Congress to examine the causes of the financial crisis and report on them to the American public, Congress, and the President by December 15th, which is looming very nearby on our horizon. There are 22 items that we're supposed to look at, plus other things that we want to consider as we go forward. And the commission is made up of six members, democratically appointed, and four appointed by Republican members of Congress. And with that, I will now stop talking.
No. So, Edgar Savendi, I think...
Hi, Wendy.
May as well start with just the most perfectly obvious question. What do you think caused the financial crisis?
Okay, well, that's obviously the hardest question. My view is that this is the kind of thing that will take many, many years to decide. I would say that I'm probably a member of a group that is, my guess is, in the majority among academic economists in terms of the view of what caused the crisis. I think the way I think about it is that in order to understand the crisis, you have to understand why credit spreads changed so dramatically from 2003 to 2005-2006. I think that probably the best explanation for that is that we had a significant inflow of capital from developing countries and oil-producing countries to the developed countries. That's unprecedented, as far as I know, in the history of the world. But that's not sufficient, because although there was a flow of capital into the U.S. and other developed countries, that occurred in 2009, 2010 as well. And we didn't see credit spreads go up. So I think that the key issue is, why is it that those countries and investors were willing to invest in relatively risky securities at lower rates than they had a couple of years earlier? I don't have the answer to that question, but I take it as a given. It's just an empirical given. Once that happened, we tended to see riskier investment taking place, as you would expect. The epicenter of that investment was in the housing market, and eventually supply exceeded the amount demanded at the time, put downward pressure on prices, and the downward pressure on prices caused a significant amount of liquidity problems, which then resulted in some solvency problems and the failure or near failure of financial firms, and that was pretty much the cause of it.
So that suggests that the actual decline in asset values was enough. What is it? Do I interpret you correctly?
I think the decline in asset values, and in particular the decline in housing, because remember, you've looked at these series yourself. If you look at the series of housing prices from 1980 until 2006, 2007, whether you look at Case-Shiller or OFAO slash FHFA, you know, those things at the national level were positively sloped throughout that entire period up until the 2006-2007 period. And I think that investors were essentially using the models from the past to predict the future, and those models turned out not to be accurate.
But why? I mean, we've had big asset bubbles burst before. You know, obviously the dot-com bubble. It's still what is the link that gets us from this decline in asset values to a financial crisis? When I would say that previous declines in asset values that were as big as you know the housing decline didn't lead to a crisis.
Well, there's a big difference in this one in that it was debt financed rather than equity financed, right? So if you look at the dot-com crash, while that was a pretty significant crash and hit a large part of the economy, certainly out here it hit a very large part of the economy, most of that got absorbed in equity values and not in debt. And so I think the fact that it was debt rather than equity caused these liquidity problems that we didn't see in the other kinds of bubbles.
And in terms of debt, should I be thinking of, you know, debt in the repo market, debt in the commercial paper market, debt at the firm level, or do you mean debt at the household loan to value kind of level?
Well, I was actually thinking of debt at the in the form of MBS specifically, but there were other kinds of debt as well. You know, you compared it with the equity market, and in the equity market, that was almost entirely equity financed, right? So that if you think about what got that dot-com bubble, now we know it's a bubble ex post. We didn't know it was a bubble ex ante. Of course, you never know these things are bubbles ex ante. But what got that thing going? Well, almost all of that was equity financing. And in the recent period, we saw a significant amount of debt financing. You know, I'm sure there was some equity financing, and some of it, the debt financing was implicitly equity financing. But most of it was debt in the form of firms and mortgage firms and other firms that were putting out this kind of paper. That was debt rather than equity.
And so at some point we'll come back to the housing bubble and various people's views on it over time. But what did we not know? I mean, what did we not see? What do you wish if you could go back to 2006? Maybe that's early enough. Maybe it's not. Is there something we didn't see?
I think that's probably not the right way to think about it. I think the right way to think about it is that everybody saw that the kind of activity that they were engaged in was risky, and that's why it commanded a premium. So, if you think about the, what do we call subprime? I mean, you guys, you were at the Fed, Wendy, at this time, and you know, the Fed really was the one it was their data that we always used in terms of thinking about subprime. And there's no formal definition of subprime. Subprime, as I recall, I don't remember if it was 250 or 300 basis points, but we defined subprime, and the Fed defined subprime, as being a loan that was 250 or 300 basis points. Again, I don't recall the exact number. Above the conforming mortgage rate. So you say, well, why is it that those loans commanded a premium over conforming mortgages? And the answer was obvious. It was that they were riskier. So it wasn't that people didn't see that they were riskier. It wasn't that they were, just totally out of it. They understood that they were riskier. The problem was, after the fact, I think that they turned out to be a lot riskier than they had anticipated ex ante. So again, I would argue that the models that they were using to estimate the underlying risk were the wrong models.
And so you don't put blame on the way the debt markets were structured. So I'll lead you in one direction just for a second, which is, for example, if you look at repo markets, one of the ways that these assets were financed, repo used to be traditionally backed by treasuries and GSE MBS. And then all of a sudden, over time,
right,
repo started to get financed. You know, you could use repo financing for subprime MBS.
Yeah.
Should we be looking at those sorts of things as how, you know, for how contagion happened? Or, again, maybe I'm, you know, maybe it's really just the asset.
Yeah, I don't really have a view on the repo market per se. It's not something that I've studied carefully and know a whole lot about. So I wouldn't really venture a guess on that. I would say that in terms of undercapitalization, there were clearly sectors that we ran into trouble in that were undercapitalized. And those are areas, I would argue that are not necessarily addressed by the current financial regulation bills. Might be something that we ought to look at. I'm not saying everything was right. I'm not sure it was specific to the repo market. Again, that's the kind of thing that will keep academics busy for 20 years. I don't really have a verdict on that one.
But. So other than undercapitalization, are there other characteristics of the financial system that you would point us to as creating risks?
I would say two things. Undercapitalization was certainly a major one. So, and when I say undercapitalization, I think of it as undercapitalization of the, not the financial sector per se, but the unregulated part of the financial sector or quasi-regulated part. So let me give you an example. The thing that I always worried about was the fact that there were these conduits, which, again, this is not a legal opinion, but my understanding was the conduits were up front in saying, look, these are off-balance sheet things, they're risky, they don't have the assets of the bank part behind them. And then when they got into trouble, like in the case of Citi, Citi was concerned that their reputation would suffer if they didn't come out and help the conduit, and so they moved assets from one part of the bank to another. In some sense, that conduit was doing what they advertised it was doing, but it turned out in reality that it was actually using the capital of the bank, and I would think that would be an area to examine for undercapitalization.
Yes, and other risks in the system.
Well, the second thing I think that was always problematic to me was Fannie and Freddie, and I wouldn't say that's the only thing. Some people think that's the major cause. I don't know whether it's the major cause, but it was certainly a cause because having an essential monopoly in mortgage securitization by Fannie and Freddie is not a good thing. It's not the kind of thing that creates long run durability and sustainability of the system. So I think that's something that we need to address.
This is Alexis. I wanted to ask you a couple questions. As someone who arrived in 2006 and was putting together things like the economic report of the president, what did you see in housing? Because obviously the economic report talked about housing a lot over the years.
Sure.
What did you see? Because you are indicating that you understood the risks and that investors did too. So I'm just curious what you saw.
No. I didn't say that. In 2006, investors were surely thinking about subprime and the risks in subprime. I don't remember featuring that. I didn't have anything to do with the 2006 economic report of the president because I got there after it was done, actually on the day that it was submitted to the president. But the 2007 economic report of the president, which would have been in December 06, January 07, we weren't focusing, as I recall, we weren't focusing on the risk of the subprime markets. We were worried about housing because of the effect, just the real effect of the decline in housing on GDP growth. So that was our major concern at that time.
And both Treasury Secretary Paulson and the President have indicated in their books that they were surprised by the crisis. And in fact, Secretary Paulson said that he had never had a discussion with the President about housing, but he had certainly talked to him about the risks of derivatives. I was just wondering how much time you had spent at CEA discussing that, just in general.
What's that? Discussing the housing?
Yeah.
Housing or the derivatives?
Both.
Housing.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly talked about housing, again, I don't want to discuss what I talked about with the president, but housing was a frequent theme of our conversations at CEA and ones that I made public as well. I think probably every time I went on CNBC, I would when GDP reports came out or jobs reports went out, and I'd be on CNBC or Bloomberg, housing was always a key topic. So it wasn't like we were surprised by housing. We knew housing was in pretty serious trouble at that point in time. We had peaked, I believe we peaked at in housing starts at late 06, early 07. I think that's about when housing starts peaked. And from then on, it was costing us anywhere between a half and a quarter and a full percentage point of GDP each quarter. So we were certainly worried about it. That was no surprise.
So you were worried about it, but the policy, as I remember, was about the ownership society. The administration was continuing its predecessor's enthusiasm for home ownership, correct?
That's not something that I remember at all. I don't even remember talking about the ownership society when I was there.
So I
came after. I think that was an earlier part of the administration.
Mm-hmm. So by the time you got there, you were thinking of housing as...
I don't even remember the term being used. I don't ever remember the term being used.
Huh. Well, that was considered kind of a hallmark of the president's disposition, and we've heard other cabinet secretaries tell us that. So at any rate, you're saying is that you saw it as much more of a mixed picture by the time you got there.
Yeah, but again, I was thinking about, I was thinking about the real economy. My job was to focus on, what's happening to jobs, what's happening to GDP, how do we see things going. And, 06, late 06 and early 07 were pretty strong. Again, I have to look at my data, but as I recall, second and third quarter of 2007 were pretty strong growth quarters. Initially, I think it was like 4.5% that got revised downward, but still pretty strong growth quarters. Despite that, we had strong growth quarters, but despite that, housing was subtracting at that point from GDP growth. So that was our concern on housing, my concern anyway.
Did it cross your mind that housing had gotten to the bubbly stage and you were looking at something that was going to end up sadly?
Bubble is not a word that I like to use very often. Bubble is something that ex post and you never know ex ante. So it's just not the way I think about the world. I was looking at the real data, and the real data suggested that housing was declining. So bubble wouldn't have been the way I would have characterized it.
So when you talked about...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
When you talked about Fannie and Freddie, at what point did you think that Fannie and Freddie were... presenting risks to the economy?
I always thought Fannie and Freddie presented risks to the economy, but that was not as a result of any particular event. It was more just a function of the structure of having implicitly government guaranteed, whether we said, and of course the government always said they're not guaranteed, but the market clearly thought they were guaranteed. I think, again, back, pre-crisis, Fannie and Freddie were raising money at like 30 basis points above Treasury, so that always was a concern to me. It suggested that we had a structure that was probably not something that we wanted to have in the long run. I like to see things where you have more diversification through a lot of different private securitizations. My view is that there's no inherent natural monopoly in securitization of mortgages. So having one or two firms, public utilities, and so forth is not something that I would particularly support.
So when the president writes in his book that he was surprised by the crisis, did you share in his surprise?
Well, we certainly, I think everybody was surprised. Certainly everybody I ever talked to, and when I say everybody, I don't mean inside the White House. I include academic colleagues. Everybody was surprised by the actual event, the crisis. Now, when you say the crisis, I guess I should ask you to define that. The way I think of the crisis, to me, the financial crisis or turmoil started in August of 2007. You know, many people define the crisis period as September 2008 and on. What I think you mean, I assume you mean August 2007, is that right?
Well, the president was talking about it more in the context of the summer and fall of 2008, so he was surprised a lot later.
Ah.
So if you're saying that to you it started earlier, then you can define surprise however you want.
Yeah, I would say I was surprised by the tightness in liquidity, you know, the necessity or the desire of central banks to have to pump liquidity into the market in August 2007. I would not have anticipated that. Now, the one thing I should say is that, Wendy, you weren't there in 2007, but I know when I was looking at the data, my job was always to report, you know, where we are pretty much every morning in terms of what the economy is doing. And I was getting concerned that the economy was starting to slow. I was looking at, you know, initial claims and unemployment. I was concerned that the economy was starting to slow as far back as the spring of 2007 and thought, you know, maybe we ought to be looking to loosen up monetary policy at that point. But that was my personal view.
Okay. So then how did life change in August 2007?
It wasn't quite just one day, although I actually do remember the day, and I don't remember if it was August 7th or August 8th, but I happen to remember the day because I was flying down to for a family vacation, and, you know, we started getting very concerned that the markets, Fed funds markets and so forth, were starting to freeze up and rates were rising pretty dramatically. That was a surprise, although I can't say that, you know, in the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to that, there weren't warning signals. Certainly the people on Wall Street were aware that things were getting very, very tight. You know, I think the guys who were better connected to Wall Street than I probably had more of a sense of that. You know, I certainly had a sense of it as well. But the August 2007 events where we saw credit markets really, really tightening and the desire of central banks to come in and pump money into the system was certainly unanticipated, at least at that level.
And then fall of 2007 on, I mean, was there a palpable difference? I mean, did life change?
Every month it changed. So, you know, my view was, and I think Ben, you know, well, I shouldn't say, I don't know what Ben's view was, but certainly my view was, okay, you know, we had an event, looks like things are back under control, looks like things are getting stabilized again, and then there'd be, you know, some other thing that would pop up, again, unanticipated. It might have been the, you know, auction rate securities market or the monolines or, you know, student loans or, you know, something would come up kind of sporadically every couple of months that was an unanticipated event. Each one of them was unanticipated. Bear Stearns, I think, was unanticipated.
You had
another one. So
you had the Bear Stearns funds, the ones that were in subprimes, the BSAM funds, went under in the end of 07, fall of 07, I think, early winter.
Yeah.
While all that was going on, did anybody... Because it seems like there's a failure of imagination or willingness to think outside the box. Did anybody think about the structure of the finance system in this country, the way things, the dependence on the short-term funding, short-term loans, overnight money, the repo market? Did anybody step back, to your knowledge, and say, what if this, what if that, what if that, is the sky really going to fall? or did it just seem like a bunch of water drops that nobody would realize would eventually erode a an entire system? Where were the casinos?
I don't remember if there were people saying, think we're really in trouble. I do remember on my own staff, we were trying to figure out where the economy was going. And I had people at Council of Economic Advisors give me their assessment of, we have to predict. It's our job to make forecasts for where the economy is going. And so we did that. We certainly went through that exercise. And some were more pessimistic than others. I don't remember whether any one person said, this is a big systemic problem, a big structural problem. Certainly at that time, I don't remember if anybody was saying that.
So, would you characterize it now, looking back, as a structural problem?
I think of this as not so much a structural problem. I mean, look, it's a structural problem in the sense that could it have been prevented? It certainly could be prevented by taking draconian measures, none of which we would ever want to have in our economy. The question is prevented at what cost? I wouldn't say it couldn't have been prevented. But I do think of this kind of thing as a series of events that came together that we hadn't seen before in our history, and those caused, because they were unusual and unanticipated, they caused serious problems that were not ones that we were prepared to deal with at the time. Fortunately, I think, and ex post, I think it was fortunate, I actually think we came out better than, we might have had reason to believe we would have. I mean, certainly this is a bad recession and not anything we want to take lightly. Things could have been worse.
I want to follow up on that. Only prevented with draconian measures. So, when I asked the question,
I'll give you an example. Yeah.
Yeah, if you could go back to 2006 and say something, is there something you could have said to prevent the crisis, or 2004 or whenever it would be?
No. Here's what I mean. Look, to the extent that mortgages were a major source of the problem, one could envision having down payment requirements on mortgages that are much higher than they are today, right? You could say you have to have a 90% down payment requirement. I don't think anybody would ever think of that as a reasonable policy, but had that been the policy, you wouldn't see mortgages causing this kind of a problem.
Wait. I have to interrupt you. I mean, what about 20% down payment?
Possibly. I mean, I don't know what the right number is. The point is, as the number gets larger, as the number goes to 100%, you eliminate the problem, but at a cost.
Yes.
And so the question is, at what cost?
No, that's right. And so, is it your view then that the only measures that we could have taken to avoid the crisis would have been draconian, or do you see reasonable measures that could have been taken to avoid the crisis?
No, I gave you two examples of things that I think we should be looking at. One, the two that I think are most important are capital requirements, and particularly the unregulated part of the financial sector, and the other was Fannie and Freddie.
Oh, okay, good. All right.
So those are reasonable things that I think we still should be looking at, despite the fact that we had major financial bill. I think we still should be looking at those things.
So okay.
we had another interview. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's also been around government, who told us that he thought that he or she thought that this was a dry forest, and that the drop in housing prices and the corresponding collapse of the subprime securitization market, the subprime values, was a match that was thrown into it, but he thought it could have been some other match as well, which implies, at least to me, that he saw a structural problem in the structure, in the nature of the economic system that we had developed. And I think you're saying part of it, because you're mentioning the unregulated part of the financial system, which we've been calling the financial shadow banking system. Do you agree with that assessment, or do you think it's
well? I'll tell you what I said. You know, I'm just going to repeat what I said before. I think if we were looking for areas where we could improve the financial regulation, it would be in the area of Fannie and Freddie, and it would be in the area of looking at the unregulated part of the financial sector and capital requirements there. Would that have prevented this crisis? You know, I doubt it. Does that mean that we shouldn't be looking to improve the situation there? No. You know, but those are two different questions.
So keying off of something else you said, that we were unprepared to deal with it. And I guess, what do you mean by why were we unprepared?
Can you I'm not sure when I said unprepared to deal with it. Can you just unprepared to deal with what? Just remind me again. I'm sorry.
You were talking about as the problems were coming in. You know, each month you would think maybe things had gotten better, and then something else would happen. The auction rate securities market, the student loan market, and as these cascading problems were coming in, you said we were unprepared to deal with them.
Yeah. Well, I think that government is always unprepared to deal with unanticipated events that come in markets. I don't think we're ever going to be prepared to deal with those kinds of things, no matter what we do. The issue is not one of making mistakes ex post. You know, what you want to do ex ante is obviously set up a system that is both high growth and for any given level of growth minimizes the amount of downside risk. But even with that, things are going to happen that you're just not going to be able to deal with. Just as natural disasters occur and you do the best you can to try to mitigate the effects of those natural disasters, financial disasters occur as well, unfortunately, and you know, you do the best you can to mitigate those effects. And sometimes we have a history and we can look at the background, we can look at data from other countries and so forth and use some of that evidence to structure our policies. Sometimes it's brand new. This one was kind of a combination of both. There were some commonalities between this and some other financial crises, but the causes, I would say, would be somewhat different here than in other situations. Again, because of the capital flows from the developing countries that were, I think, unprecedented.
A lot of people have pinned much of the blame on excessive risk taking, and you're an expert in compensation and incentives. Although I'm not sure that what I'm about to ask you is right within your sweet spot, but do you have a view as to compensation structures, incentives, you know, the whole moral hazard problem, and agency risk issues on Wall Street as to whether or not they were a significant contributor to the excess risk which brought so many firms down?
Well, let's put it this way. I have not studied, you know, particular firms. I certainly don't have data on the compensation plans that these firms were using, so there's no way I could give you an informed opinion on that. I will tell you that most of the time in the academic literature, the concern is actually the reverse. It's not excessive risk-taking. In fact, 30 years of agency literature is about the opposite. It's that the agents, the managers, are actually too risk-averse. They don't maximize the expected value for the principals because they're actually worried about their own jobs. So it's it's kind of the opposite of what the academic literature has been concerned about. But again, I don't have any particular information about what happened during this period. I'm sure people will be studying that. You know, you'll start to see papers on that, and it'll be something that over time I think we will get some evidence on. But at this point, I think it's mostly speculative.
Well, it's funny. There actually have been there are a few papers now that have been written. Of course, as you know, you go back to that principal agent literature. So much of it was about how fabulous it is that compensation was now tied to whether it was measures of profit or equity, the equity prices and stuff like that to align incentives. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting.
Yeah, but that usually makes you more risk averse, right? Not more. If your compensation is tied to profit, then what you want to do is, if you're risk averse, you'd want to adopt a low variance strategy, not a high variance strategy. Right? So think of it this way. If I'm a guy on a piece rate and all of my compensation is based on that piece rate and I'm risk averse, and I can draw from two distributions, a high variance distribution and a low variance distribution. A risk-averse guy, other things equal, is going to want to draw from the low variance distribution. So that's been the academic characterization of this problem.
But I guess what I've read some stuff over the past couple of months that has said, okay, mm-hmm. if you have these high enough payouts, if you take big enough risks and you get high enough payouts, you actually only need to hit once over a couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, and so
that's true.
So you take really
that's
big
true,
risks and you get a really big payout and you don't really care about the bad years anymore.
No, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's right. That's just the upside. If you're risk averse, again, what you're going to do is, if you're given a choice between a risky distribution and a less risky distribution, other things equal, you're going to choose the less risky distribution. Even though one has a big upside, a risk-averse agent is going to want to choose the less risky one. So, you know, again, I mean, there's an enormous literature on this stuff, most of which, by the way, is not written by me, but the seminal piece on this is probably Bengt Holmstrom's in 1979.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of the way that literature evolved. So, but again, I wouldn't deny that there certainly might be examples of firms that set up compensation schemes that did induce people to take risk. That could be true, but I don't have any evidence one way or the other on it.
Can I ask you a question about the rating agencies? Did you learn anything that you didn't know about them?
Hmm. I've certainly learned that they made a lot of mistakes. Whether, you know, I wouldn't say that I learned anything much beyond that, but we know ex post that the ratings that they gave didn't seem to conform with the expectation. Again, that's not unique to the rating agencies. I think that, unfortunately, that's what the market was saying as well. The expectation, again, going back to credit spreads, the expectation is as reflected in credit spreads seems to have suggested that, you know, the people engaged in those markets, not just the rating agencies, but the people who are engaged in those markets also thought that while these kinds of investments like subprime were risky, they weren't as risky as they ex post turned out to be.
And I just want to make sure I understand, you believe that investors, for instance, abroad, understood the risks, that they could see them in Norway and Germany?
No, that's too strong a statement.
Okay.
What I said was they surely understood, the market surely understood that subprime was riskier than conventional mortgages. That's why they paid 300 basis points more than mm-hmm. conventional mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the same statement that as they understood the risk. I would interpret they understood the risk is that their ex-ante evaluation of the risk conformed to the ex-post evaluation of the risk, and I think we know that was not the case because the market underestimated the risk ex post.
Okay, I see what you mean.
At least that's my view. That's my view.
Well, it could just be that the market got unlucky, right? They could have had the exact right distribution, the exact right expectations.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. That's a good point, Wendy. Although, my sense is that they probably, you know, this was... It's possible that this is just a bad draw from the distribution that they were using. That's certainly possible. My guess is that firms that are estimating the risk now going forward will be using a different model.
Well, so
but it is possible. You said is possible. That's
no,
right.
No, but I guess so. It's not just an academic sort of question because there's a question as to whether or not firms had the wrong distribution. Or had the right distribution, but they were underpricing. You know, they thought that the probability of certain outcomes were slim, right? So I guess what I'm saying is there are different ways when people say firms were under or market participants were underpricing risk. There's lots of different things that can mean. It can mean it never occurred to me that house prices could fall. I just have the wrong distribution.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Or it could
right.
be, I think house prices may fall, but if they fall, I actually think that monetary policy is going to do a really fine job cleaning up the mess because that's what they do. They mitigate the effects of bubbles being burst. And I don't think that state of the world is going to be very bad.
Do you? Or you could think, or a third would be, you think that state of the world is going to be very bad. It's in your distribution, but it's a sufficiently low probability event that the risk premium that you're earning compensates you for that.
That's right. That's right.
Actually, so those are the three. Yeah, I agree with you. That's a nice way to put it. And I don't think we can tell at this point, which of those three is an accurate description. Or I certainly don't have any personal evidence on it.
The only evidence I have on it is actually not mine. It's a paper that a friend of mine has written where he's actually gone in and he looked at the pricing functions. This is apropos of nothing, by the way. Sorry, but he looked at the pricing functions that a number of lenders used. You know, lenders that have gotten really unlucky ex post. But he looked at their pricing functions. Their pricing functions were spectacularly great. They just had the wrong probabilities. So, if you put in different probabilities, you come out with the exact right ex post prices. They just had the wrong distribution of house prices.
Of probability of outcomes.
They were conditional on house prices declining 10%. They had the price of that loan nailed.
Have you spoken to Daryl Duffy, by the way?
We have. Yes, we have.
Yeah, okay, because I would assume you had. And Daryl, I'm sure he talked about this as well because, he's talked about those ex-ante and ex-post distributions and whether the credit spreads were fat or thin
at
the time.
So, exactly.
But he's the expert on that stuff. You know, that's not my area of expertise. I haven't researched it, so I wouldn't venture an opinion on it.
So one thing that we have to ask you about is the response to the crisis.
Go ahead.
So, was it optimal? I'm going to guess probably not. And in which ways was it not?
Well, you helped me design it, so so you're implicated as well. And when you say the crisis, I assume you're talking about September through December.
I mean, though that's not quite right. No, because. Uh-huh. We may as well, now that you've raised the date issue, go back in time. I mean, certainly one of the things, this is a bit beyond your purview, but one of the things that the government's been criticized for is a very, inconsistent response.
Ad hocery.
Yeah. You bail out Bear, you bail out Fannie and Freddie, you don't bail out Lehman, you bail out AIG, you don't bail out WaMu, you do bail out Wachovia. I think I would want to roll it back before TARP.
Okay.
So why don't you be
a little more specific? I mean, I'm happy to tell you what my view is, what my view was then and what my view is now on each of those events. I mean, I can certainly do that.
That would be spectacular. Helpful. Should we have bailed out Bear Stearns?
Well, I'll tell you what my view was then. My view at the time was, yes, we should. And I was happy that we did it. I think my view now is that it had very little effect on doing anything to mitigate the effects of the financial crisis on the economy.
Why do you say that?
Because I think at the time, most of us believed that contagion was really the thing that was dictating what was going on in the world. And I think I certainly don't have that view anymore. I believe there's some contagion effects, but I think most of it is a common factors explanation. And what that means, of course, is if it's common factors, saving one firm doesn't do a whole lot to, erase the underlying causes of what's going to cause the system to have problems later on.
So common factors. I mean, then how do you explain student loans, auction rate securities, freeze up in credit card securitizations?
Well, it's easy. I mean, it's the same thing. It's like suppose every firm has a large number of mortgage-backed securities, and mortgage-backed securities end up losing a tremendous amount of value, which causes a liquidity crisis that ends up, because of fire sale dynamics, causing a solvency crisis. Okay, but every firm, suppose every firm had exactly the same proportion of mortgage-backed securities in their portfolio, fixing one of them would do nothing to help you with the others.
Well, but that's right. But, of course, that's not – they didn't all have the exact same amount.
No. That was a expositional simplification. They don't have to have the same amount.
Yes, I understood that. But, I mean, that there were some, you know, Goldman Sachs,
right.
was, you know, if anything, probably, you know, right around, you know, zero in terms of the – neutral in terms of their exposure, but maybe even, you know, certainly at some points shorting the market. There are certainly other firms.
Right, and they got into less trouble, but there were plenty of firms that got into trouble. And again, I would say that most of it, I believe, was the common factors issue. So I'm not a big believer. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. It's interesting. No, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. I'm not a big believer that in the view that Lehman, you know, was the cause of the crisis. I mean, many people believe it is. I don't believe it was. And the reason I don't believe it was is that Fannie and Freddie essentially failed the week before. Merrill was failing that same weekend. Wachovia and Washington Mutual essentially failed within the next couple of weeks. AIG failed on Wednesday of that week, I believe. Most of these had nothing to do with Lehman. The one that did have something to do with Lehman, I think, was this Reserve Primary Fund and the run on the money market. So that surely was a spillover contagion effect. So I wouldn't argue that there was no contagion, but even if you had been successful in saving Lehman, the other guys were still out there, and those shoes were going to drop.
Well, how much of that shoe dropping is attributable to market overreaction and panic as opposed to some rational analysis of balance sheets?
Boy, I don't really have an opinion on that. I would say, my view is that those things were going to happen, whether it was because of market overreaction or whether the reality of the balance sheets is, it's almost irrelevant at this point, except going back to what I said earlier, which is, you know, if we're thinking about the future and how we would try to, you know, at least reduce the probability of something like this happening again, I guess you'd want to know the answer to that question for that.
So I'm so confused. So let's go back to Bear. You were enthusiastic then about helping. And your thought?
Excuse me, everybody. With respect, okay, I think what Mr. Lazier said was his judgment then was that it was the right thing to do. And enthusiastic is an altogether different characterization.
Okay,
mean to get involved too much, but I think these subtleties matter because you guys are going to write something up. It needs to be faithful. So.
Okay. I stand corrected. So you said what you said, and then you said... And then you said something after that, which now I hesitate to repeat, but my interpretation of it was that you've changed your mind about that, right? About
Correct.
Bear.
Correct.
Okay, so now I want to take you back.
Correct.
Knowing your thinking now, and your idea about the common factors, what would you have done differently then, or advised differently?
Well, I actually didn't advise anything on Bear Stearns, so I wouldn't. It's a question that's not actually relevant in terms of my actual advice because I was not involved in those negotiations.
Okay, but what would the United States of America? What should it have done differently? Maybe.
Okay, I would say that saving Bear had very little positive effect, and whether we do that or not, again, it involves a trade-off, because I didn't say there was no contagion, there was some contagion, but it came at a cost, and the cost is the, you know, moral hazard associated with it that we all know about. We always were worried about moral hazard. This came up later, obviously, in the context of the loans to the auto companies. It came up in the context of the TARP. It was something that was there's always tension between the moral hazard that you create in the future and the effects that you have, the positive effects, hopefully positive effects that you have in the short run. So, you know, that's always a trade-off, and whether you make that trade-off correctly or not, I think depends on the specific situation.
So bringing us to TARP.
Yep.
So, you know, I guess I know a little of your thoughts on TARP, but the SCIC doesn't.
So, you can share them with us.
we'll
leave you, Wendy.
Yeah. So tell us your thoughts on you know, once the goal was to come up with a more systemic approach to dealing with the crisis. Was it in what ways was it not optimal, or was it optimal?
Well, as you know, Wendy, I think, you know, again, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I actually think you were my person on this. You and Mike were the two key players on this.
Yes,
and,
but I can't quote myself in the book.
Okay, good. All right. Well, let me try to speak for you and for myself. hopefully, I won't mischaracterize your views, and if I do, you can write nasty things about me.
Yeah, and Alexis will if you don't.
Yeah. All right. The view that I think the Council of Economic Advisers had at the time was that there was a very significant amount of potentially toxic assets in the system. And we had a number of different estimates of those depending on how you define toxic assets, but I recall actually a meeting with you and Mike, I think, where we had numbers that probably ranged, again, I'm stretching my memory, but I think it was somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion, depending on how you define the toxic assets. And so, you know, we felt there were significant toxic assets in the system. As a result, our view was probably the best way to use TARP was to make sure that the financial firms had the wherewithal to survive the shocks rather than to try to clean the toxic assets out of the system. And there really were two reasons for that. One is that even with a very large TARP, you know, $700 billion divided into two tranches, 350 each, you know, you're still talking about the first tranche buying up something like, you know, 10-15% and leaving the rest out there. So I think our view was that probably would not be sufficient to do much to get the markets going again. And then the second thing was the implementation problem. It's not easy to implement a buying scheme in a very short period of time, and that's what was necessary. We had to, you know, get the money to these financial firms very, very quickly. And to do that and to design a scheme that, one, protected the taxpayer, but, two, got the right assets, right toxic assets out of the system was something that I didn't think we could accomplish in a short period of time. So it was for that reason that the CEA, and when I say the CEA, I was the chair of the CEA, so this is my view, what favored the going in the direction of capitalizing the financial sector, you know, in the form of, say, doing something like buying up preferred, which is what we ended up doing.
And one of the things that we've talked to Secretary Paulson
about... Is that okay, Wendy?
Yes, it was. Thank you very much. One of the things that we've talked to Secretary Paulson about are the strings that came with TARP when it was first implemented, the strings that were imposed on TARP over, you know, over its life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have thoughts on whether or not those, you know, compensation or other strings were a good idea, a bad idea? Obviously, there are lots of people who criticize the TARP program for not nearly having enough strings. It didn't, you know, mm-hmm. demand lending requirements, that sort of thing.
I think, you know, again, I think that the compensation requirements were probably a necessary part of the design for a variety of reasons, certainly appearance, political, perhaps moral hazard for the future. So I don't really think that there was any other way to go on that. I don't think there was much choice, just given the constraints of the system. I do think probably the most important feature of the way the TARP was designed was that it did allow for the firms that did take the money to exercise call options to get back out of this stuff and get out of it pretty quickly and pay the taxpayers back. And I think that actually worked quite well. So, you know, we didn't know it at the time, but I think if you look at the history and what happened, you know, in 2009 and 2010 with those firms that were the beneficiaries of the first wave of the TARP, I think that, that actually worked pretty well, both in terms of what it did for those firms and also in protecting taxpayers. So I actually think those strings, if you call them strings, or those terms, conditions, were probably positive aspects of the way it was designed.
So I think we just have a few more questions for you. I think we're
going
to turn to the economy.
Part of the mission of the
part of the mission of the
FCIC is to talk about the economic fallout of the crisis post 2007 and 2008, and I just wanted to ask you in general, you know, how does the economy look to you now, and in the context of a book that comes out in mid December, what concerns you looking ahead? What concerns you most looking ahead about where we are?
Well, I'm most concerned, as I always was, about the labor market. I mean, that was my concern, not just after the crisis, but before the crisis, when I looked at the housing market and saw, you know, that things were slowing because of the housing market. I was always concerned about what that would do to the labor market, and I think the major concern now is that the labor market, as it always is slow to respond, but I'm concerned that this particular time it may be even slower to respond than we would hope. So that's a major concern. That's where the pain is felt, and I think that's, you know, that's the problem. I'm not sure that we have an easy remedy for that problem, but I would say that that's the major concern.
Okay. Is there anything unusual about the way the labor market is shaping up, or how slow it is? Something that we should focus
on?
Well,
that's a, you know, again, that's kind of an academic question. I've thought about that, and I actually gave a talk on that in London a few months ago. It's not unique to this recession. It actually showed up in the prior recession as well, and I'm sure, you know, Wendy is certainly aware of these data, but if you look at productivity and how it varied over the business cycle, is the pattern that we've seen over the past couple of recessions is different from the pattern that we used to see back, say, in the 50s and early 60s, where productivity would decline, looked consistent with a labor hoarding model back then. Now it looks like the reverse. So the labor market seems to be changing in terms of the way it behaves, both in cyclical downturns and then in the recovery. This may have to do with the movement away from manufacturing towards service economies. Skills are more general in service economies than they are in manufacturing, so it may have something to do with that. But again, you know, now that I'm back in academia, I can have the luxury of saying that's the kind of thing that we're going to research over the next 10 years. I don't have to give the president an answer on this tomorrow.
Thank you.
So.
Is there anything that you'd like to add? Anything that we haven't?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think you're pretty comprehensive. So, you know, seems like we covered most everything. You know, these are things I've thought about since then, and pretty much told you what I know.
Is there any interesting detail that you could share with us from the September 2008 period of what it was like to live in it, to live in that? Can you tell
Well, I read President Bush's chapter on the financial crisis, and I would just simply echo that. I don't want to tell you what was going on in the rooms and so forth. I will tell you that it was a period during which we were very concerned that things could go very, very badly for the United States economy. They certainly went bad. You don't like to see a recession where you have 9.5% unemployment. That's one of the worst things that has happened during my lifetime in terms of the economy. But you know, we anticipated a significant probability of things being much worse, and so I would say that there was certainly a lot of nervousness about that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I shouldn't interrupt you. I will interrupt you later.
I was just going to refer you, again, I'd refer you to President Bush's chapter on the financial crisis, which I have read, and I think it's certainly an accurate description of the way I think about the world.
What was it like for you, though, personally? I mean, were you pretty much living there in the office? Did you go home and tell your wife at 3 in the morning, my God, you know, I mean, I'm looking for just, because we've heard a lot of these stories, and they're so interesting. Just people who put their...
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, the one thing that I will tell you is, and this was public, I mean, I had planned to leave. I had planned to leave CEA. My mother was dying. I had planned to leave CEA on September 26th. I gave up my apartment, September 15th, the Lehman stuff hit, and, you know, we had Fannie and Freddie the week before, and so I had to alter my plans and ended up staying till the end. So obviously, I certainly thought that this was the kind of situation where the president's chief economist doesn't take off, no matter what's going on in your personal life.
Right.
You know, it's a couple of years now, and yeah, it is a couple of years, and I think perhaps people's memories have lapsed a bit. How bad could it have been without the extraordinary efforts that that you and Secretary Paulson and the rest of the crew and the money that was dumped into the system? How bad could it have been? Because I think that people are not appreciating the precipice that the economy was on.
I think it could have been very bad. You know, if I look back and I say, what are the things that were done that made things better. My view is that the financial, the crisis part was significantly assisted by some government action. I don't think we did everything perfectly. Certainly, the discussion we had about the TARP and what my views on the TARP were would fit into that. But overall, this is uncharted territory. It was not the kind of thing that where we had a playbook and we knew from past history what to do. I think people were doing the best they could. Everybody was trying to do what they could do. And I think, part of it was that the judgments we made were pretty good judgments. They were reasoned judgments. And part of it was, I think, some things broke the right way. We were in the middle of a panic. It is not easy to stop a panic from happening in the middle of it, and the panic did stop. So that's a positive piece of news.
If it hadn't, what then?
Oh, I don't know. If you compare the current recession, again, albeit a very bad recession, to the Great Depression, unemployment in the Great Depression was 25%. You know, this unemployment peaked at 10.1% in this recession. So, this is a far cry from the Great Depression.
So maybe this can be one of our last questions then. The current state of the labor market,
mm-hmm.
How do we link that to the financial crisis? Other than just the loss of wealth, and that has a wealth effect, is there a link to the financial crisis?
Well, I think most of it had to do with investment because if you go back, that was Wendy, right?
Yes.
Okay. If you go back, Wendy, to Q1 of 2009, when GDP fell by, and again, I'm stretching my memory, but I think it was about minus 6%, something like that on an annual basis. Most of that was a result of a very significant decline in investment. I think investment declined 50%, so that was the major contributor to that minus 6 that we saw then.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at Q4 of 2009, investment came back by, I think, plus 40% when we had a pretty strong positive quarter. So I would attribute most of the action there to movements in investment. Consumption declined, and consumption, of course, is a big part of the economy. But this seemed to be one where panic in financial markets and tightness in financial markets that persisted through 2009 prevented firms from investing in the way that they otherwise would, and I think that slows the rehiring of workers and still continues to be a problem in labor markets.
And so that panic has continued. I mean, in some respects.
No. I don't think the panic has continued. I think the panic ended. We didn't know it at the time, but I would say the panic ended probably in late 2008. I couldn't give you an exact date.
Right.
But I don't think there were subsequent panics after probably November of 2008. That didn't mean that financial markets returned to normal. They certainly didn't return to normal until much later, and I'm not sure they're normal now. I'm not sure what normal means and whether we want to go back to the kinds of financial markets that we saw in 2006. But we certainly had tightness in financial markets continuing through 2009 and probably even into right now, which has an effect on investment. But I wouldn't call it panic. I don't think there's a panic going on now, and certainly wasn't a panic that I saw after the late 2008 period.
So, yes, so I shouldn't have said panic, but loss of confidence? Does the loss of, you know, if you look at business confidence, should we tie that back to the disruptions in financial markets years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any question that what happened in financial markets certainly affected investor confidence, but beyond that, it affected real things, and the real things was, you know, you might say, well, because of confidence, these things resulted, but what was real was that lending became much tighter. I mean, you know, just think back to where we were in September of 2007. Fed funds was up close to 7%, you know, and you just didn't see things like that, so that meant that capital markets were essentially frozen. Banks wouldn't even lend to one another overnight. And, you know, whether you call that confidence or real factors, doesn't much matter. At that point, we didn't have a lot of investment capital flowing through the system.
And still don't, to some degree, yes?
Well, I would say things are still tighter. You know, things are still tighter than they were, again, back in 2006, 2005. But I'm not sure where we want to be, and you know, there's controversy on that. You know that I'm half time at the Hoover Institution. I have a very distinguished colleague, John Taylor, who certainly made his views known on our current policies and think that things are, if anything, significantly too loose. So people are debating that one. I don't feel like I have a strong view one way or the other. It's kind of you know, something that I want to see evolve over time. But I would say investment right now, it's still taking time for that to get back to where we're going to see significant growth in the labor market. And that's, you know, that may be the reality. It's unfortunate because of the effects on the labor market.
And that's key to the restoration of confidence, yes?
What's key to the restoration of confidence?
The labor market performance.
I don't know that it's key to the restoration of confidence. I don't like these measures, you know, these sort of psychological measures of confidence and that sort of thing. I look at the real numbers, and the real numbers that I look at are things like, you know, investment flows, growth in investment, the stuff that really contributes to GDP. So I'd probably restrict my attention to those kinds of figures.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. This has been very helpful, I think.
Yeah.
And
okay, good luck and good luck with your work, Wendy and company. And I know you'll be working long hours, and look forward to reading your report.
Thank you.
Long hours.
I'm gonna turn up.